songs about that time right about now.
Right about now. Right about, right about, right about now.
Well, hello, everybody. Welcome back to Right About Now. Happy New Year! It's Jonathan Small here with you, ringing in 2019. Took a little break. Very happy to be back because it was very lonely without you. On the show today, we have Gabriela Pereira. She is the founder of DIYMFA.com. A do-it-yourself alternative to a master's degree in writing. She's also a speaker, a podcast host for DIY MFA Radio, and the author of DIY MFA, Write with Focus, Read with Purpose, and Build Your Community. Gabriela is going to drop some knowledge so you don't have to spend a lot of money to go to college.
When people join our community, when they sign up for our newsletter, one of the first things that they'll get is an email asking them, what are you struggling with right now? And I read every single response that comes in. And over time, we started to see patterns. In the beginning, a lot of the questions that I got were very craft related. I need to understand plot structure. I need to understand character development. I'm having a hard time with point of view. But over the years, it's actually become sort of more fundamental and also more psychological. Questions like, I just don't feel confident as a writer. I don't feel like I'm allowed to do this. I'm having a hard time focusing on one idea. How do I find the one idea I should work on right now?
So that is going to be a very interesting conversation indeed. But before we get there, I want to rattle off some of my writing New Year's resolutions 2019. All right, are you ready? I resolve to spend a lot less time looking at my news feed on Twitter and Facebook and thinking about Donald Trump. I resolve to be more honest in my writing. To write what scares me, to write what's uncomfortable. I resolve to grow this podcast to twice its size as far as audience. How I am going to do this, I have no idea. I resolve to launch other podcasts in addition to Write About Now. I've got one rolling for Green Entrepreneur, which will debut next month. I have another one, which I can't announce yet, but I'm excited to share with you when it comes up. And then there's got to be one more, because four is the magic number for some reason. I resolve to write a viral blog post. One viral blog post this year. I think I can do it. Listeners to the podcast will remember my conversation with the blog post whisperer. And I am going to take some of his advice and write a heavy blog post to kind of to get some virality. I resolve to read a new book every week. And if I don't read one, at least I'll listen to one as I hit traffic in my car in Los Angeles. And I did get a new car. Did I mention that to you? Yes, I bought a Subaru. I have been driving Priuses for the past 8 years, but I was getting tired of people trying to get into the backseat of my car thinking that I was an Uber. I resolve to start something new, to start a new project, to maybe stop doing some of these projects that aren't going anywhere and to just start a new project, whether that's writing, a podcast, something else, but just something new. I resolve to make more friends in the podcasting world and in the writing world. How I'm going to do this, I have no idea. I resolve to spend more time marketing my podcast, marketing my writing, and maybe less time creating, because marketing is just as important as creating, even though I hate it. I resolve to guest on other people's podcasts, because how are people going to find out about my podcast if I'm not on other people's podcasts? Plus, sometimes it's nice to not ask all the questions. All right, so those are some of my resolutions. I'm going to come up with a lot more. What are yours? Let me know. All right, so here is my conversation with the lovely Gabriela Pereira. I hope you enjoy listening as much as I enjoy talking, and we'll talk to you on the other side. Gabriela Pereira, welcome to Right About Now.
It's so great to be here. I'm super excited.
Tell us what DIY MFA is and why you created it.
So DIY MFA, put simply, is the do-it-yourself alternative to a master of fine arts in writing. Essentially, our mission is to help writers get the knowledge without the college. And I'm doing air quotes here, although you can't see me. But basically, our goal was to, it has always been, to give writers a format, a framework, a rubric that they can apply to their lives so that they can take their writing to that MFA graduate school level without actually having to be enrolled in school. And the reason I started this program really was because I was in an MFA program and then I didn't want to leave. I was one of those classic examples of like the student who doesn't want to graduate.
The 8 year
and so
senior,
I had this like panic moment at the end of my second year where I was like, I'm graduating in a few months. What do I do? And so I decided to like create a plan so that I could keep things going, keep the same energy going that I had had in the MFA program beyond graduation. And essentially, I started blogging about this idea and people just loved it. And it really resonated with a lot of other writers. So I realized like, maybe there's something to this. And DIY MFA was born.
But you're not sort of saying, okay, you don't need an MFA, so take my DIY MFA courses, correct?
I've never wanted to hate on the MFA for practical reasons, first and foremost, because I don't like haters, so I would never want to be one. But I also think that the MFA program itself can be, like the traditional version, can be very, very useful to a very specific type of writer. The problem is that it's the only option out there, or one of the few options out there. There are very few alternatives to that approach, to that universe. And so a lot of writers end up in MFA programs who really shouldn't be there. And some of the issues, for instance, are that MFA programs are very good at serving writers of literary fiction, writers of poetry, writers of essays. But if you're writing something that's more commercial, that's more in the mainstream, you're going to be a fish out of water. You're going to feel like an outsider. And I had that experience because I was in an MFA program and we had, you know, the poetry, the fiction, the nonfiction essay groups. But then we also had a writing for children group. And I was in that writing for children cohort. And our entire cohort, there was only about 11 of us in that year. And we always felt kind of like outsiders because we were the only ones writing stuff that would probably get picked up by a major publisher and would probably, you know, go on to be career writers. And yet we felt like we were these outsiders in this world because all the other groups were like, whoa, you guys can actually write? Like, that's so weird. So the whole purpose of DIY MFA was to give a home to writers like us. And the reason also is because the writing for children cohort, like there's only two or three programs in the entire United States that have a specific writing for children major in an MFA program. And if you're looking at genre fiction, like romance or thriller or mystery, there's maybe one or two programs in the entire United States. So there's a huge number of people writing in those areas who want to improve their craft, but there aren't any schools out there that are helping those writers, that are targeting and focusing on what those writers need. And so DIY MFA started out as an alternative so that those writers could adapt the MFA traditional format to their own needs.
Why do you think this is that we're sort of stuck? I mean, I feel like it's the same with music. Like if you want to study music, they really only teach like jazz and classical, right? Like my son is really into rock music, but there's no like sort of way for him to study that. Why is it that it's so narrow in scope?
All right. So I'm going to get like really like, I'm just going to let it all out. All right. I have a lot to say on this.
Nice.
First, I think that it has a lot to do with the fact that the people who are running the establishment are kind of snobby. Like, at least not all of them, but a large number of them are. And there is this kind of snobbery around, you know, this is high art and this is low art. And I actually did my TEDx talk was all about this conflict between what people think of as art versus what people think of as like the craft. And the fact is, craft is about doing the thing, whereas art is all about examining and critiquing and, you know, being inspired by watching someone else do the thing. And to me, that is asinine, because art should be about getting your hands dirty and actually doing the work to accomplish what it is you want to accomplish artistically. So I think that there's a huge amount of snobbery that goes into that problem. But the other problem, I think, also has to do with cognitive dissonance, that there's this perpetuation of the establishment because the people who have gone through it feel like they either need to be 100% for it or 100% against it. It's very hard to sit in the gray area. And the gray area is where DIY MFA has always very precariously sat. And what I mean by this is, if you think about folks who are going and getting MFAs, and again, I don't mean this as a way to bash MFAs, it's just a different framework to look at them. People who go to these programs, they are spending a lot of money, they're investing a lot of time, they're probably abandoning jobs, leaving their hometown or going somewhere else, living in, you know, places where they're maybe not the most spectacularly glamorous places, so that they can afford to go to this program that is not paying them. Most MFA programs, there are a few that are fully funded, most of them are not, and you have to pay a lot of money to go to them. So you would imagine that once people have kind of gone through this process and made these sacrifices, that in some way they're psychologically invested in wanting to, in the fact that they have made the right decision. It would be very cognitively problematic if you went through all of that, you sacrificed all that, you spent all that money, and then you realize, like, oh yeah, this kind of sucked. Like, nobody wants to be in that boat. So there's this incentive sort of inherently in us as humans, and it's in psychology, it's called cognitive dissonance, where if you have sacrificed a lot in order to get a small reward, you will automatically be more invested in that reward because you've had to make that big sacrifice. On the other hand, you might have people who sacrifice a lot and they feel like they were gypped, like they were jilted, that this was the bad idea. And then those are the outspoken, like, you know, I'm against the MFA people. And DIY MFA, we strive to sit in that uncomfortable but more realistic space of saying that, you know what, it's not all good. It's also not all bad. It can serve some people well, other people not so much. And let's help people make an informed choice about how they want to invest their time and money and educational energy.
Sounds really interesting. I feel like I need to take a few courses there. Mm-hmm. Why do you write?
Why do I write?
Yeah.
That's a very bizarre question, because I can't even imagine not writing. I write because I work things out on paper. I am a builder. I'm a maker. That is sort of how my DNA is. Like, I don't solve problems in my head. I solve problems on paper or in materials. Like, I'm very hands-on. So for me, writing has always been the tool that I use in order to work out problems. And you can actually see this if you go through my journals and notebooks. Like, you can track back and see seedlings of DIY MFA from 2010 or 11 that have now come to fruition, but they were all being kind of sketched out and worked out and written down on paper. As far as like, how, why do I write like artistically and like what inspires me and all that stuff? Well, I just kind of do it because I can. I became a writer when I was in first grade. That's when I realized that being a writer was actually a job.
Thing. Yeah. How did you realize that in first grade? Just somebody told you?
So I was in the library, and, you know, back then it was like, I went to this elementary school where they had all the different grade, like the books were all like separated by grade or reading level, right? And so I, being the sort of snotty little first grader that I was, I marched right into the fifth grade book section and pulled a book off the shelf. I still remember the exact book that it was. It was Lloyd Alexander's Book of Three. And I pulled it because it had this really cool picture. Like, I started reading it because it had this really cool picture on the cover of this dude on a horse. And he was like holding a sword, and he had like a head that was like had antlers, like a skull head with antlers. And I thought it was awesome. So I started reading it. And I read the first page, and then I read the second and third page. And then by the time library period was over, I'd read the first chapter, and I promptly had a meltdown right there in the middle of the library. I started freaking out. And my teacher, the librarian, had no idea what was going on, but eventually she was able to suss out from me that the reason I was panicking was because if I could read that book in that fifth grade section of the library, then I could read every single book in that library. And if I could read every single book in that library, that meant I could read all the books in the world. Mm-hmm. And you know, as a first grader, I just sort of assumed that if it was in our library, those were all the books that there were out there.
In the world.
So all of a sudden I freaked out because I thought, oh my gosh, I'm not going to have anything else to read. I'm going to be bored forever and I'm going to die. So I had this momentary panic. The librarian talked to me a little bit, and then I guess she must have talked to my teacher, because the next day our classroom teacher brought in this activity for us to do where we could make our own books, and we could write a story, and we could staple the pages together and make a cover and draw the illustrations, and then she would put it in the book corner of our classroom, and we could read it aloud to the rest of the class in during story time. And so that was a moment where I realized that, like, there were people who wrote the books. Like, up until then, I just sort of assumed that the books existed, and I thought it was, like, you know, spontaneous, like, existence. I didn't realize that there were human beings who actually wrote the words that went into the book. And so that was the moment when I realized, like, wait a minute, people write books, and I could be one of those people. So that's been with me since I was in first grade. Like, once I realized, like, I could do this as my job, it was pretty much inevitable. Like, this is what I will do.
That's awesome. I want to go back. You had mentioned that you write to work things out, and that your notebooks are, like, you know, all you kind of crafting out DIY, MFA, and all these other things that you're working out. Tell me a little bit about your process. So do you do, like, morning pages every morning? Or are you one of these people that always has a notebook with them and is always kind of writing stuff? Or do you have sort of a process to it? Is there a method to your madness?
Morning pages. Yeah, I tried those for
Didn't work for five minutes.
You know, the problem for me with morning pages is the morning part of that equation. My brain is not fully functional until about 10 a.m. And then at that point, like, if I'm not actually at my desk doing work, the day's a wash. So that whole idea of, like, waking up early to write and stuff does not
work. Right. And just to our listeners, morning pages is when you kind of get up and you just sort of freehand write, like, three pages, I think it is, of whatever comes to your mind. It doesn't, no judgment. It's like a meditation almost, just to get your, I will agree, like, I never could find time or the will to do it, even though it sounds like such a great idea. But you seem to have another process. I'd love to hear about it.
Yeah. And I legitimately tried morning pages. Here's the thing. At DIY MFA, we have this approach where there is no one way. And so, like, I hate to say this is my process in sort of a didactic way, because the process I would rather listeners learn is not the one of how to get words on paper and work things out on the page. The process I would rather people learn is how to assess your own process and find the way that is your best practice. And so at DIY MFA, like, I actually did morning pages. I did it solidly for, like, a year. And by the end of that year, I realized I was just being a whiny pain in the you-know-what on the page whenever I was doing those morning pages. And it was not serving me. I was just whining about stuff. I was not being productive or creative. It was bringing me down rather than lifting me up. And so realizing that, I recognized for some people, Julia Cameron's method is phenomenal. But for me, that was just not going to work. So the way I tend to, I'm very visual. I come from a graphic design background and a product design background. In a past life, I was a toy designer. Aside from wanting to be a writer since I was in first grade, I also wanted to design toys from when I was in first grade. And now DIY MFA allows me to marry both of those passions, because I'm designing educational interactive experiences for people online. So it's basically like toys and books together.
What toys did you design? Like, what kind of toys?
I did everything except art and craft kits. So I worked at a small specialty toy company, and I was in charge of their bath line, their preschool line, their spy kits line. That was a lot of fun to test.
Oh, yeah. You
running around the office with, like, little walkie-talkies and stuff. It was really
so
fun.
Cool.
I was in charge of their outdoor toys. So, like, anything that was, like, you know, frisbees or kind of like Nerf style stuff that you could play with outdoors.
So you're saying that your design background sort of informed your process of kind of getting ideas down and stuff on paper. And so I cut you off there.
Yeah, so it's kind of a hot mess, I'll be honest. Like when I write, when I work things out on the page, I'm just sort of sketching things. I do a lot of mind mapping where I'll take an idea and then I kind of brainstorm anything that'll come from that idea. I create a lot of flow charts and things. And the other thing I do a lot of is, and I learned this actually when I was in college, summer between high school and college, I lived in London and I did a summer long internship. And I remember going to this exhibit of Degas sketches at one of the galleries there. And one of the things that you see in Degas' work, when you see those old sketches, like we're used to seeing like the beautiful oil paintings and the sculptures and whatnot. But if you go and look at the sketches that he does before he did the oil paintings, he basically sketches and traces the exact same thing a bazillion different times. He's just tracing his own work again and again and again. And what was so impactful with this exhibit was seeing all of the sketches that then led up to the paintings we know and love. And what I took from that was that for me, a way that I kind of process things is I will sketch and resketch the same idea. I will mind map the same concept and just tweak it slightly every time until I get to a place where like I've refined the idea enough. I can see it on the page and I'm like, all right, this is it. Like now I know what I'm doing. Now I know what this project is. So with DIY MFA, I have literally notebooks, multiple notebooks of mind maps and sketches and snippets of concepts.
I've heard that mind map, and maybe you can give me an example of something that you mind mapped and like how it would work. Because I've been curious about mind mapping. I've never tried it.
So how about we mind map DIY MFA? Because that's okay. easy for you, right? Walk through. It's top of mind. So basically you put the main idea in the middle of a piece of paper. So I'd write, if in this case, I would write DIY MFA and I put a circle around it. And then I start thinking like, what are some of the big categories? So DIY MFA now in the current iteration has three main buckets. There's the writing bucket, the reading bucket, and the community bucket. So I'd have three lines, you know, branching out from that central circle. And I'd write writing, reading, community on each of those lines. Then in each of those lines, I'd probably branch it out. Okay, so what kinds of communities would writers want to have? And so I might say like, all right, communities with other writers, like conferences, communities with publishers, like professional associations, you know, communities with your, like building your platform and connecting with your readers. So I might branch it out. And then maybe in the platform branch, I think, okay, there are different things that you need to do in your platform. Like you need a website, you need to think about social media, you need to think about, I don't know, what else, your author headshot. And so in all of those things, you kind of keep branching things out until it sort of creates, it looks almost sort of like this like sprawl of neurons on the page, and the ideas just sort of go in all in two dimensions. But what I love about mind mapping is that it lets you see the whole idea in a glance.
Right.
Because when you outline things like in a list or when you write things longhand, you can't capture the idea just by looking at it quickly. But if you mind map it, you can see it and it's like, okay, now I see the scope. Like this is the lay of the land of what I want to cover with this concept.
Yeah, now I got to try that. I've never mind mapped, but it sounds like it would be a good process for me. I'm very much somebody who ideas come to me all the time and they're in my head and then I forget them. So I need a better process for remembering them. Now, you know, thank God for iPhones. I do pull it out sometimes and go to the notes section and just type down these random things. But those kind of get lost, you know, too. Like, so, you know, it's good to have it all down somewhere. I think all writers should probably have some sort of process to get their ideas down, because you do forget your ideas. You have these great ideas all day long and then they just go away. And it's hard to, I don't know what the way the brain works, but it's hard to figure stuff out in your head.
Oh yeah. Yeah. You know? I mean, there's some people who can figure things out in their head, but I cannot do that at all.
I agree.
For me with the, like, I'm not much of a note taker like on my phone, but occasionally when I do get some sort of concept that's really, really juicy, what I do is I email it to myself, because I'm really good at it, ignoring text messages and ignoring, I'm a horrible human being when it comes to technology. But the one thing I will not ignore is email. So if it lands in my inbox, I will have to deal with it at some point. And so that's my way of keeping really important pieces of information top of mind.
Oh, that's smart. That's smart. So you talk to writers a lot. You teach writers. I'm curious, you know, and even in preparing questions for this interview, you know, it's always interesting to try to figure out, like, what are some of the biggest challenges that writers face, and how can we help them overcome those challenges, including myself. And I'm just curious, in your experience, like, what are some of the most common sort of questions you get or challenges that are presented to you? Like,
so it's funny that you bring this up, because at DIY MFA, we have a very, when people join our community, when they sign up for our newsletter, one of the first things that they'll get is an email asking them this exact question: what are you struggling with right now? And I read every single response that comes in. My assistant reads every single response that comes in. And over time, we've started to see patterns. In the beginning, a lot of the questions that I got were very craft related. This was back in 2010 when DIY MFA was just getting started. So I need to understand plot structure. I need to understand character development. I'm having a hard time with point of view. But over the years, it's actually become sort of more fundamental and also more psychological. Questions like, I just don't feel confident as a writer. I don't feel like I'm allowed to do this. I'm having a hard time focusing on one idea. How do I find the one idea I should work on right now? So nowadays, those are the kinds of questions we're seeing most often, are things around confidence and around focus and productivity.
So let's focus on those two issues, because they're really important issues and totally resonate with me and other writers that I've talked to. And I, you know, I think all creative people struggle with confidence. I mean, I think it's the biggest myth in the world that, you know, creative people are somehow, like, you know, wake up every morning and feel like, you know, I'm Picasso or whatever. They're constantly feeling, you know, there's that imposter syndrome and all sorts of thoughts that come in that tell you that, you know, you're not good at this. Why are you doing this? So what are some of your suggestions to help build somebody's confidence?
So it's, I guess that there's sort of two ways I could attack this. I could talk about sort of what a person can do for themselves versus like what I try to do to help our, you know, people in our community. Essentially, the way I try to help people in our community build their own confidence is by being really real with them. Mm-hmm. So when I'm going through difficult stuff, I share that with my audience. When I, you know, there have been times where I've given them a window into my writing process. Spoiler alert, it involves a lot of gnashing of teeth and tearing of hair and,
yeah, you know,
four-letter words, but allowing people to see that even someone who may have reached a certain level of success, and I'm doing air quotes again, reached some sort of level of success, still has that difficult time. That, I think, gives people permission to realize, like, okay, it's, I'm fine, because everyone goes through this. On the podcast too, when I interview authors, we interview a lot of best-selling authors, and it's kind of amazing to me how many of them, even though they're like number one New York Times bestsellers, they struggle with imposter syndrome too. And that's like amazing to me, but also really refreshing, because yeah, it makes me realize, like, I'm in good company. This is normal. So I think in terms of like what can people do for themselves is try to put yourself in environments where you get that, where you're not just hearing from so-called experts, but you're seeing people being real about the creative process and places where you can see the process at work. It's a lot easier to kind of get excited and motivated when you see people doing the work, whether, as opposed to like seeing people just kind of talking about the work. And again, it goes into that craft versus high art thing. Like, craft is about getting your hands dirty. So be around other working writers who are writing actively. Yeah. Don't just sit around in coffee shops talking to people about how such and such book, you know, recently released book is so passe, because that's just going to bum you out.
Yeah. So again, find a community, right? Find a community of writers, whether it's through DIY MFA or however you do it, but to be around other writers. And do you recommend taking classes? Is that another way to do it?
Sure. That's certainly another way to do it. But again, it's no one size fits all. For example, listening to a podcast like this one could be a way to feel like you're part of a community, even though you're not actively participating in it, but you're getting to hear from it. It's more about exposing yourself to people who are actively working, not just talking about the work, and also people who are being real about the process, as opposed to people who pretend like it's easy, even though it's not.
Anytime a writer tells you that it's easy, they are, they are not telling the truth.
And there's also like a certain level of privilege too that comes into play. It's funny, I have an interview that's coming out later, early next year with Jeff Summers, and we talk about this, where like there's a lot of writers out there who are, you know, they say things like, you know, yeah, like write like it's your job. You need to write full time, or you need to write as much as you can, or whatever. Like your real job is not as important as your writing, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, okay, that's great if you are a number one New York Times bestselling author and you can afford to quit your day job. But if you can't, there's a reality there that you have to work around. And so hearing people talk about that reality is much more productive than sort of aspiring to this, you know, dream that, let's face it, may not happen for every single person. And so let's live in reality as opposed to in aspiration land.
Yeah. And as far as confidence goes, also just do it, right? I mean, it isn't, you know, we spend so much time sort of torturing ourselves about, you know, what should I be writing, and I should be writing, and I, oh God, I got to make time to write tonight, or mad at ourselves for not writing yesterday, or, you know, instead of just like doing the work, or at least just putting something on paper, right? I tell myself that all day. I mean, I'm the same. I'm, again, you're talking about being real. Like sometimes I just hate writing. It's not for me. It's not something that I just want to do every day. I know some writers have that gift that they just like can't imagine not writing. But for me, like it is like I have to make myself do it. Once I start doing it, I kind of like it, but I have to get motivated to actually start writing is hard for me, which is why I've always had jobs, full-time jobs where I have deadlines and, you know, somebody's paying me to write something. But just to sort of do it on my own, I find that challenging.
Well, and there's another thing that people don't talk about when it comes to sort of the motivational aspect of writing. For some of us, writing or not writing is not a choice. For me, and this is something I've become a lot more vocal about in recent years, I landed on writing because I have a health situation that does not allow me to have a full-time job in an office. It is not compatible. I have bipolar, and that means that I literally had to quit my job in the toy industry because I could not take the medicine I needed and also drive a car to work. Oh, so it was this like conflict, like, do I survive or do I keep my job? Like, what are the two, you know? And so, and I realized, like, for me, writing is a job that is compatible with my situation because I can do it from home. I can do it around the ebb and flow of bipolar. And so because of that, it's like, yeah, I don't love it all the time, but it sure is a lot better than what could have been the situation where if I had stayed in like a structured office job, it would not have been pretty.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. So as far as confidence goes, I want to keep talking about confidence because I need to build my own confidence in this conversation. So keep writing. So, you know, be in touch with people who are writing, expose yourself, as you said, lots of exposure. What else do you suggest to build your confidence?
Well, I mean, the thing with writing is that the more you do it, you eventually get better at it, right? Like practice goes a long way. But as my late great violin teacher used to say, Gabriella, practice does not always make perfect. It makes things permanent. Pay attention. And so sometimes, and this is where I think morning pages don't hit the mark, they miss the mark, is that if you're doing something by rote and you're not really thinking about the skill you're practicing in that writing session, it can actually make something permanent that you don't want to be permanent. Now, in theory, morning pages are supposed to be about just unleashing your creativity. But for me, I realized that they basically made my whiny teenager angst voice come out, and that was becoming permanent. And I didn't want that. I didn't want that to be the voice that came out on the page. So I realized I needed to find a different way to do my writing and to work out my ideas so that I could be practicing the right skill. I also am a firm believer in like incremental practice. My kids are both in Suzuki Music School, which is what I also studied when I was a kid, hence the violin teacher.
Yeah.
And the whole Suzuki method is about each song you learn, each song in the books builds on the techniques from the song before. So like the first song is all like the notes go up and they go down like step by step. Then the next song you have skips between the notes. So you're learning now to skip your notes. And there's like the same thing in writing. You don't want to just attack the great American novel head first, because you'll probably fall flat in your face if you've never written before. But if you slowly start to exercise different muscles, practicing different types of characters, different types of situations, different points of view, different types of voices and language, you can then build up those skills that will then serve you well when you tackle a big project.
No, I love that advice, because I feel like that is one of the biggest barriers that people have with writing, is that every time they sit down, they think they have to write, like, this is now my masterpiece. Like, I have to write my book. Like, how about just writing an article, like a 2-page article, you know, first or whatever it is. But yeah, to sort of not set yourself up to fail, because I mean, who's going to write the great American novel on their first try?
There's also a part of it too, where you can be strategic with the small stuff to help you serve the bigger projects. So I actually just wrote a newsletter about this yesterday, where, you know, one of the things, I've been working on this big secret project now for like well over a year.
What is it? Just kidding.
I have this feeling in my gut that like, this is going to be the thing that usurps DIY MFA. I can't believe I just said that on air, but I have this feeling in my gut that this is like the next big project for me, but I haven't been able to share it publicly yet. Yet I have been testing out different pieces of it in freelance articles that I'm writing.
Are you running for president? Is that what you're about to reveal? Okay. That's not the
right. Hells no.
No. Okay. So you've been testing out parts of your new project. How have you been testing it out?
So various different ways, doing talks at conferences. I will take a little piece of the project, and then I will build a presentation around it, like a, you know, breakout session or what have you. Writing articles. I've done some freelance articles. One of them that I did about a year and a half ago, it was like more of an overview of the concept and why the concept is important. More recently, I took one little piece of that concept and did a deep dive on it. So like people who are like observing from the outside, they probably wouldn't know what the big project is, but like I know, and I know that I'm like testing these different things to see what resonates and what doesn't. The great thing about blogging or doing like online articles is you can then see in the comments when people respond or when people tweet it out or share the links, you can get a sense for like, wow, this hit the mark. That one, not so much.
Right.
And that can give you some like real data on whether you're on the right track or not.
So that is a good way to seg to this idea of focusing, because you mentioned that's another question that you get. And I do recall at one point I had sent out an email to some of my subscribers and asked them, you know, what's the one question that you want to ask? And I know a few people did say, like, I don't know what project to work on. Like, I have all these ideas and I don't know which one to focus on. So that does seem to be a common issue. Tell me some of the advice that you have on that.
So as far as knowing what project to work on, so funny you should mention, because that actually ties to the big secret project.
Yes.
I don't want to talk too much about
it. All right.
But for me, it's not a very scientific thing. Like when it comes to fiction, I've been working on a framework to help writers figure that out. But when it comes to like the nonfiction, like for me, it hits me. Like I get this feeling in my gut where I'm like, ugh, this is the thing. And I remember when DIY MFA, when I first started playing with this idea, it was like maybe June or July of 2010, I was sitting in the kitchen at my parents' house and I'm like, Mom and Dad, I know you think I'm crazy, but this is going to be my legacy. I know that this is my thing that I will do for the rest of my life. And they looked at me like, you know, oh, it's just Gabriella being ridiculous or whatever. But now I'm like, see, this is the thing. I did it.
That's awesome.
But there's nothing scientific about it though. Like it kind of hit me. So the way I would say it for people who are, if you're struggling, do like the coin flip trick. You know, the one where you like, you flip a coin and you say, all right, heads, I do this, tails, I do that. And then you look at it, you'll get a feeling in your gut. Like if it's tails and what you really wanted was heads, you will get that sinking feeling in your gut. Hmm. And so I would tap into that and sort of go with the thing that really resonates with you, because at the end of the day, writing is hard. So you don't want to be committed to a project and realize like, you know, 150 pages in that you don't like it anymore. I've been there. It sucks.
Yeah.
So instead, if you kind of focus in on the thing that you really love, the characters you love or the story that you're really drawn to, you kind of can't miss, because even if that project ends up not getting published, you still learn a lot in the process of writing it, but the odds that you finish are actually better than if you picked a project that you're kind of like, meh. I don't know.
Yeah, I agree. I think that one sort of factor, though, that also comes into that decision is always like, is this commercially viable? Like, and then like that thought pops up. And I think sometimes that thought can be a destructive thought, even though it's a practical thought. And sometimes things that are practical are not necessarily constructive because, you know, I know I've had that thought where it's like, I want to write a screenplay. You know, I have this great idea for a screenplay, but then I'm like, wait a minute, I've got two kids and a full-time job. And, you know, maybe I should actually just not write a screenplay and I should write something like a book about my podcast. You know, it's like, this is my mind. This is how my mind works. It's like all over the place, like, you know, doubting, reconsidering. So I'm wondering, yeah, like, should the economic calculus even come into it?
Okay, so there's sort of two sides to this, right? When you're writing your first thing, then absolutely not, in my opinion. Absolutely not. Let your future agent worry about whether or not it's commercially viable.
Right.
Because your job with your first project is to finish it. It is not just to like see about getting it published and making, you know, being a commercial success. You just need to finish the thing so that you can learn from that process of finishing and then either go on to sell that thing or write something else that's even better. Once you're in a place where your career has started to pick up and you've built a brand around your writing, you've built something of an author identity, as it were, that's when you may want to think about these things. So like I've had to struggle with this in a few cases over the past years. After the DIY MFA book came out, I had to start thinking, okay, do I want to be doing more books on writing and kind of that's going to be the thing I'm known for, or do I want to branch into a new thing? Or do something that kind of extends DIY MFA more into the mainstream, in which case, what is that thing? So that those are things that my agent and I have had a lot of back and forth about. We've had conversations about like, what are the different projects I could tackle? And for me, then it becomes a cost-benefit analysis because I'm thinking, okay, if I do write another book, it's going to require X number of hours per week. That will then be deleted from my daily schedule, which means all the time that I'm spending running the business will now have those hours depleted from it. So then I need to think, okay, is the value of the book to my career, to my brand, and monetary value also equivalent to the lack of those hours in my business? And the answer I've come up with has been no. I've had several times where I've had projects and I'm like, yeah, it's not the right time because the business is far more valuable than writing the second book.
Right.
But if it's a bigger book that reaches a bigger audience, that's a different beast. That would then change the equation. But when you're writing your first book, your job is just to get it done so that you can actually like, you have a place to start from.
No, I love that. That's your first job is just to finish it, right? It's so hard to finish anything.
Yeah.
And I can't tell you the amount of things that I've started that I haven't finished, you know? Usually I will always finish a story that is assigned to me or a story that I have pitched and was bought by a magazine, et cetera. But my own projects, that's a little bit of a different animal because that requires you to actually make your own schedule.
So there's a little trick you can also do that I've used that can help with that. In the tech startup space, they talk about ooching, like, you know, let's ooch our way into this new fangled app or whatever. And it's basically like another word for like iteration, like we're going to do a beta version of this and let's see if it works. And so, but you can do that in our writing because what you can do, let's say you're thinking about pitching articles, and I do this all the time, like that big secret project and those articles I was writing, those are all articles I pitched to magazines and then I wrote, or I pitched to websites and then I wrote. And so I was getting paid to write these articles that I now know are laying the groundwork and building my presence around this new idea that I want to work on. So you can like beta test your big project by doing these smaller projects, and they can be paid projects like by pitching to magazines. They could also just be like writing a short story. If you have a character that you're thinking, I might want to write this novel, take one of the characters and just write a short story about that character and see if you like them so that you don't get to page 150 and realize, wow, this guy's a jerk. Why am I writing about him?
Yeah, no, that's a great, great advice. Oh man, you got lots of good advice. Can I just keep you in my pocket for these crises that I have?
My mom used to say that like you just press go and she just talks, and I'm like, yep, that's me.
I actually had a chance to listen to your TED Talk, which I recommend that everybody check out. It's on YouTube.
and you talk about myths. One of my favorite topics from my magazine background, we love to do stories about myths. One of the myths that you mentioned, and we talked actually about a few of them already, but one of them is the problem isn't out there, it's in your head, that idea. That the obstacles, that all the obstacles that we create for ourselves for not writing, for not deciding what story to write, is actually kind of more on us, right?
Yeah. I mean, basically, as you know, and this again goes back to like, there's a whole psychological foundation of it. It's a lot easier to blame our day job, our annoying family, our loud neighbors or whatever, or that horrible commute. It's a lot easier to blame those things for not writing or not doing the creative work instead of looking inward and realizing like, oh no, I didn't do that because I just didn't do that. And, you know, a lot of times writers, anyone creative, we get stuck in like, I can't mode. And I do this too, where I'll be like, oh, I can't do this. I don't have time. I can't do that. I don't have, you know, the resources or whatever. And I can't is kind of like a victim perspective, right? Like if we're saying I can't, we're coming at it from a mindset of like, we're the victim. I'm the victim. I can't do it because some big bad thing is keeping the thing I want away or preventing me from doing the thing, creating my art, writing my book, etc. And one of the most liberating things I learned to say was, I just don't want to. And that has become like a catchphrase in my life where I will just be like, you know what? I'm not going to do this because I just don't want to. And being okay with I just don't want to, and taking ownership for the fact that like, you're not going to do it and you're making an active choice. Like, I'm not going to go out to whatever cocktail networking thing because I just don't want to and I want to write my book. And then it becomes an active choice and you're empowered as the person who's driving the bus, as opposed to like being buffeted around left and right by all these external forces.
Let me play devil's advocate with I just don't want to, which I think is actually a really brilliant way to phrase it. But sometimes what you don't want to do is what you should be doing, right? Like, it seems like sometimes, you know, I think we are inherently, sometimes we're pretty lazy. We can be lazy or we're procrastinators, right? So I just don't want to do it. Does that enable you to procrastinate by saying that?
So at DIY MFA, we have this thing we call it, the saying, honor your reality. And honoring your reality basically addresses the tug of war between the reality of our regular everyday lives and then our creative lives, right? And the way I often explain it is that, you know, most people, they try to find, and I will, this does address your question, by the way, even though it's kind of a detour. But the way I explain it is that most people want, they think of the conflict between our real lives, our day jobs, our family responsibilities, our health, our finances, whatever, and our creative lives, our writing. They think of that as like the way to solve the problem is to find a balance. That's why people are always talking about work-life balance or family life work balance, all that stuff. I think balance is utter BS. There is no such thing as balance. Instead, I think of honoring your reality as being on a boat. So when you're on a boat, if you try to stand perfectly balanced, what happens? You fall on your face. But if you allow one thing to pull you and then the other thing to pull you, and one minute your job is pulling you and then the next minute your writing is pulling you, and you start rocking back and forth between the two different pulls, eventually you find your sea legs and then you're able to stay upright. So in a way, it's almost like a contradiction. By allowing yourself to be out of balance, you actually achieve what you were trying to do with balance. So how does this relate to, you know, like using the I don't want to as a procrastination tool? Well, you know, when you're honoring your reality, when you're saying, okay, I really can't write today because my kid is sick and they're vomiting every 5 seconds and I need to help them, versus I just didn't feel like writing today because I wanted to watch SVU episodes and eat bonbons on my couch. Like, you can call yourself on your own BS. That is part of the honor your reality mantra, is like, you need to call yourself when you're on like your own nonsense. But you know, like, when you're just making excuses versus when you're actually legitimately, you know, honoring your reality by acknowledging, by saying, I just don't want to. The other thing too is that we often say, we have a very hard time, I think a lot of us as creative people, saying, I don't want to external things. Whereas the internal thing, like the writing, the stuff that kind of feeds our soul, that is a lot easier to say, I just don't want to, or I can't to. And so I can't is often the way that we try to deflect the external problems, the things that are vying for our attention from outside and trying to get in our way. And so my, what I would love to sort of reframe for people is to give them a framework so that they can take ownership and like be empowered in dealing with those external forces and saying, you know what, I just don't want to deal with this annoying boss who's making me do this crazy thing that's totally outside my job description. And you know, take ownership for that decision.
Yeah. Are you a believer in writing prompts? Do you think they're very important?
I do. I think that they need to be used well. So one of the things that I see a lot of people doing writing prompts, but they, again, it's kind of like they're all over the place and they're practicing by rote, but they're not really practicing with focus. So one of the things, I mean, when I work with writers one-on-one or even in our courses, one of the things that I try to do is give exercises that are specific to a particular skill. Then it's very focused because the writer knows what they are trying to master, what they're trying to achieve. And that way they're practicing in a way that serves them, not just for the assignment in front of them, but for all the assignments that come after, all the stories and essays and novels, because now they will have mastered that skill.
Yeah. No, that's, it's sort of like the Suzuki, a little bit like the Suzuki method. Yeah. Kind of building on that. Yeah. Cause it can be kind of arbitrary. What do you find one of the most effective? I mean, again, it's different for each person, different for each situation, but is there one prompt that seems to really build somebody's confidence or just kind of bring, it always brings out something fresh from them? I had somebody on recently, a woman, Susan Shapiro. I don't know if you know her. She's in New York. Mm-hmm. And she has this thing called the humiliation essay where you know, her prompt is like, what's the most humiliating thing that ever happened to you? I thought that was interesting, kind of different way of looking at that kind of an essay. Is there one that you particularly like?
So I love setting limits on things because writers really struggle with this idea of limits. You know, like we feel like it'll clamp down on our creativity if we somehow like create boundaries. And yet by creating boundaries, what you're doing is you're focusing that creative energy so that it is like even more channeled in that one direction. So a lot of the exercises that I give writers, especially when they're first starting out, exercise this idea of setting limits. And one of my favorites is actually on the DIY MFA website. If you go to writerigniter.com, like all one word, you'll see it'll basically, it's like a slot machine for writers. And you hit the little shuffle button and it goes and then you get a character, a situation, an object, and a picture. And you have to write from that. And so the reason this works is that there's the randomness of it, right? That like you could have things that completely contradict each other. So how am I going to make this, you know, this random character fit with this other situation that makes no sense? And yet somehow your brain becomes even more creative because you've limited those choices and you've sort of forced yourself to solve this problem. So in general, the general advice would be like, you know, limiting options. And there's like a million different prompts I could give for that. But the Writer Igniter is probably the one that's top of mind.
I'm going to try that. Are you a big believer in outlining? Are you one of these writers who sits down and writes, or do you feel like you need to have an outline before you write a big project?
It depends on the project. When I write fiction, I generally don't outline for like the first third of the project. If it's a short story, I don't outline at all. I just write it. If it's like a longer like book length project, I usually will go about 20,000, 30,000 words into the project. And then I'll be like, okay, I've got this mess in front of me. How do I make any order or sense out of it? And that's when I start to figure out like what the story arc is and where it wants to go. And then I outline meticulously and I go from there. But generally I, in the beginning, don't really, I only kind of know like one or two scenes ahead of where I am. And then I kind of build organically from there until I get about a third of the way through. When it's nonfiction, generally I do these, like I call them just add water outlines, where like I'll free write just on one page, not free write, but sort of like it's sort of a cross between mind mapping with a whole lot of like different colored markers. And it's just a big jumbled mess to anyone else. To me, it makes complete and total sense. And I do that. And then that sits on my desk next to me while I write. And like from that one page, I can extrapolate a 100-page long master's thesis or a 5-page article or a 300-page book. Like it kind of just that one thing, like somehow that jumbled mess in my brain kind of translates to the project at hand.
Aside from your own book, what is a book about writing that you recommend people read?
Oh, there's so many. I mean, I'm looking here at my bookshelf. There's like, I have an entire bookshelf.
Is there one you ever gift people?
Different ones for different scenarios.
Yeah.
Like I love Zach Pettit's book on freelance writing. I forget what it's called, like The Essential Rules of Freelance Writing.
Oh, cool.
I love James Scott Bell's books. I'm particularly a fan of The Art of War for Writers. I have a couple of go-to prompt books, like The 3 a.m. Epiphany is one of my favorites, as is the Now Write series. Those prompt books are really useful because they're organized by topic. So you can actually do focus practice from those prompts because you can choose like prompts that are only on character development or family relationships or dialogue or whatever. And then exercise those skills. It makes it a lot easier than ones where like the prompts are just random. And then I'm trying to think, I mean, there are just so many books that I absolutely love. I mean, right now I'm reading Writing Without Rules by Jeff Summers, and it's hilarious and also useful.
Yeah.
Which is always a good combination, you know, when it's both entertaining and helpful at the same time.
Well, this has been so enlightening and fun. Thank you so much, Gabriella, for taking the time to talk to me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to Write About Now, hosted by my dad, Jonathan Small. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to his podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever you may find podcasts. Or you can go to his website, writeaboutnowmedia.com, and listen there. This is Ella, reminding you to
do the right thing.
Thanks, Ella.
You're welcome.